Grow Plants with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Adrian. Welcome to the 69th episode of Robots and the first show of 2011. Today we have a look at the next big market in robotics, agriculture. To get an expert view, we speak with Joseph Jones from Harvest Automation.
Then for a fresh start into this new year, we decided to upgrade our website. Our partner, robots.net, will now provide us with the news. You can access each episode's news items, along with many others, via the website's new news tab, which replaces the former forum. We think that this will increase both the quality and accessibility of our news content and look forward to your comments in the improved comments section under each post. Speaking of the news, Christine, it's on to you.
Thanks, Sabine. A series of robotics novelties were showcased at the annual Consumer Electronics Show, CES, this week in Las Vegas. Among the most remarkable novelties was a new telepresence robot by U.S. company iRobot called Ava. The working prototype uses Microsoft Kinect-type sensors for safe navigation. It moves using Omni-wheels and can be controlled by using an iPad mounted on its height-adjustable head or by simply pressing touch sensors around its neck. Another interesting robot was demonstrated by CMU's Quality of Life Technology Center. Rather than using a stiff robotic arm, the group showed how an assistance robot can use inherently safe inflatable arms to perform tasks like sponge bathing a patient. Other novelties included the Weemi massage robot from Dreambots, which you may remember from a previous report, two new RoboV-humanoids by Japanese company V-Stone, a new scuba floor scrubber by iRobot, the relaunch of robot toy dinosaur Pleo by Involabs, the Hornbot vacuum cleaner robot by LG Electronics, the first US demo of Cyberdyne's Hail exoskeleton, and the smartphone-controlled sphere robot, essentially a small remote-controlled sphere. For a complete summary, have a look at our website at www.robotspodcast.com.
Thanks, Christine. Joe Jones is a robotic visionary with 24 years in the field. As proof, he was the first employee of iRobot, where he invented the Roomba that is probably vacuuming your floor as we speak. He also spent 9 years in robotic research at the MIT AI Lab, offered 3 books on robotics, and holds 15 patents. Today we have him on our show to talk about Harvest Automation, a company that he co-founded. Tapping into the huge agriculture market, Harvest hopes to deploy thousands of robots to nurse our plants.
Hi, Joe. Welcome to Robots.
Hi, Sabine. It's great to be here.
What is the goal of Harvest Automation?
The goal of Harvest Automation? Well, Harvest Automation is a corporation, and like any good corporation, our goal is to provide value for shareholders. But I think beyond that, one of the things we'd love to do would be to create a new industry, or at least participate in the growth of a new industry, because agricultural robotics would be a great industry to create. It doesn't really exist now. There's a few small examples, but we'd like to expand that a lot.
Why agriculture robots?
Well, we didn't start with the idea of building robots for agriculture. We started with the idea of building a practical robot, and we looked around for a good application. It turned out that one of the best applications that we could find happened to be in agriculture. So that's why we settled on that. In fact, our name originally was not Harvest Automation. It was Q Robotics, and we changed it to Harvest Automation when we found this application in agriculture. So there's a couple of things that make the particular application that we found a good one, and that is that it's sort of one technology step beyond the kinds of robots that we'd worked on before, and it seems like there's a lot of other possible practical robots that are very close to the one that we're building. And I thought maybe I'd just tell a little bit about the story of Roomba, since some of the founders worked on that. Roomba was this wonderful application. It's a simple robot. It's a robot that cleans floors, and everybody has a floor. So after we had developed the Roomba, people would come to iRobot and say, "Well, you developed a robot that can clean my floors. How about a robot that can clean the windows? Or how about a robot that can clean the toilet?" And of course, the truth is that the technology that you would need to do those other robots that people wanted was completely different from the technology that we had developed to do Roomba. So Roomba was sort of this beautiful island. It's a great application, but there wasn't anything really close to it that would allow you to, move on to and build the next robot in the series. But I think the application that we have found is different from that. It seems like there are a lot of paths forward to other similar, closely related robots.
So let's maybe dive into the robot so that we understand this technology step better. What type of tasks do you want these robots to do?
Well, our first product will be in the nursery and greenhouse industry. And in that industry, there are a lot of sort of repetitive manual tasks. The workers who work in those industries, they have a hard time of it. The worker productivity is very low and the conditions are difficult. It's often hard to get anybody to do those jobs. So the kind of back-breaking, repetitive jobs that people are doing now, we would like the robots to be able to help with. And basically that means moving the pots, plants that are growing in containers around in the hot sun. There will be a lot of that.
How is this robot different from the Roomba? So what are the technology steps you need to actually do such robots?
They are both... they use differential drive, which means that they have two drive wheels that can turn independently of each other. There's no steering wheel. So it's the same kind of, the same type of platform that Roomba used. Roomba's task was to cover an area. So basically it could do that by just moving around randomly. When it encounters a wall or some other obstacle, it would turn away from the wall. And that was fine for a task like cleaning your floor. It's also fine for a task like mowing the lawn. And there are some examples of robots that use basically the same strategy that Roomba used to mow the lawn. The robot that we're building is bigger than Roomba. That's not so much it's still a small robot, but it's bigger than Roomba. But the thing that's different about this robot, the HA1 we call it, is that it has a manipulator. And that's the sort of one step beyond Roomba. Roomba accomplished this task basically by rolling around, but the HA1 has to also move about, certainly, but it deliberately changes its environment. It finds plants growing in containers that are sitting on the ground, and it moves them into... It collects them, it spreads them out into ways that the growers need to have done. So it's a little bit more complicated. I think we've estimated that the complexity of this robot is maybe 3 or 4 times that of Roomba. We think we've got a good handle on it, and we're making rapid progress to make it work.
Tell us a bit more about the HA1. What does it really look like? What are its sensors and actuators and such? On top of the manipulator?
It's still a very small robot. It's about, it's roughly circular. It's about a half a meter in diameter, and it's about half a meter tall. It has a gripper that sticks out the front. It's basically a 1 degree of freedom actuator. It only needs one motor to make it work. It lowers the manipulator, drives forward. It can collect a pot in the manipulator, then it raises the manipulator, and now it can carry the pot around. And the principal sensors that it has a wide-angle range sensor, and it uses that sensor to identify plants growing in containers. And it has a reference. It needs to know its position in the world fairly well, and we have a very simple way of building a sensor, a sensory system that will give it that. And so basically there is a sensor that detects a reference mark that we put in the world. And those are the basic sensors that it has. Other sort of internal sensors like current limit sensors and encoders and a gyro to help it navigate. It has all those as well.
I imagine that the pots are not always at the same place. How do you actually deal with the unstructured environments?
Well, the unstructured environment is the challenge in mobile robotics. And first, partly we deal with that because the environment in which these robots operate is not completely unstructured. It's not as if they were, you know, going out into a forest and trying to chop down trees or something like that. The area where they work has some constraints on it because people are growing plants there. And some of the important constraints are that it's basically flat. They're not giant boulders or trees or anything that the robot has to constantly watch out for and discriminate against. It's basically the plants are grown in a flat area, and in a lot of cases, growers even put this stuff on the ground called ground cloth. They use that to suppress the growth of weeds so they don't contaminate the plants. So we have this fairly nice area to work on, and within that area, about the only things that you're going to find are plants growing in pots, and the pots are pretty much all the same size, and other robots, and occasionally workers will walk by, or occasionally there'll be some other equipment on the field. So first you start off with an environment that's not completely unstructured, and then beyond that you add sensing to sense the critical things, and clearly the critical things are the pots and the other robots. And also, on top of that, we use a behavior-based programming model, which is the same model that that we use for Roomba.
That's really interesting. So we saw the Roomba that works in really unstructured environments. There's also Kiva Systems, which is more on the sort of structured environment scale, similar to what you're explaining here. Where do you position yourself in terms of structured environment? Do you think you can go much further in the future and towards having, you know, robots in real fields?
Yes, absolutely. That's the direction that we'd like to go. We want to solve only the problems that we have to solve and gain experience in a partially structured environment before we move on to environments with even less structure.
Do you think the behavior-based approach can actually help you in the unstructured environments?
Oh, absolutely. That's what it's best at. The behavior-based approach is basically a reactive approach. The robot senses something with its sensors. There's a bunch of different behaviors that are running simultaneously in the robot. The robot picks the sort of the most salient behavior to deal with what it's sensing, and it acts immediately. The behavior-based approach was very much developed to handle unstructured situations, and it seems to do it pretty well.
What type of challenges do you have with outdoor robotics?
Well, with outdoor robotics, basically, sun is one of the most difficult ones. The kinds of sensors that people build to, you know, detect range and to, you know, make the robot aware of other things in its environment, the most effective kind of sensor that you can build is an active sensor where you send out a pulse of light or something, and then you look for the return of that pulse. There's lots of sensors that use that modality. But sunlight messes that up. Right, it sunlight tends to saturate your receivers, and it makes everything more difficult. We didn't really anticipate. We've been working on our own range sensor, and we didn't really anticipate how difficult that was going to be because the sun is so bright.
So, in terms of how these robots will interact with the farmers, how do you see this interaction developing?
Well, the way that the interaction happens is critical to the success of a robot. It's not enough that, you know, the robot do something useful, but whoever's running the robot has to be able to tell it what the robot should do. So the task that we're doing is fairly simple, so it doesn't need a huge amount of interaction. In fact, I'll describe it a little bit. Basically, what usually happens in this application is that you have a bunch of plants in containers. Those plants are delivered to an outdoor field on a wagon. The plants are placed on the ground, and then they have to be spaced relative to each other. You have to leave a certain amount of space from one plant to another. Too much and you're not using your field effectively, too little, and the plants tend to grow into each other, and you can't sell them then. So the thing that the information that has to be conveyed to the robot is, where do the plants go? How wide is the field that you're spacing them on? And how much space should you place between the plants? So the way that we've handled that is we have a marker that indicates the edge of the field. The workers lay down a marker. And the reason that we thought it was okay to use a marker in this way is because when people space fields now, that is when they put plants in the field at an accurate spacing, the first thing that they do is they run a rope down the side of the field, and then they have a grid or something else that they align with the rope in order to figure out where to put the plots. So since they're already doing that, we thought the first step of having the workers lay out a special rope that the robot can see wouldn't be a problem and would seem natural to them. And then the only other things that they have to do is they have to sort of dial in the pattern that they want the robot to space the plants in, and they have to tell the robot how far apart the plants should be. So there's a very small amount of information that has to be conveyed, and we do that, one, physically with rolling out this marker that shows the edge of the field, and then by having the worker turn a couple of dials, you press the button and the robot takes off.
How do you see the program interface? Is it really like a portable device or?
Well, there's not really any programming that the users have to do, other than, you know, turn the dial to select three or four parameters. We think that'll be very easy for them, and that'll be familiar to that they'll be familiar with equipment that has similar interfaces. Really, there's no programming that the user has to do at all.
Okay, so these dials are on the robot. I hadn't understood that.
Yes, that's what we plan.
Okay, well, as a startup, you're currently developing. Where do you stand?
Well, currently we're working on our third generation prototype. You know, kind of go through our history. We were founded by four founders who left, who all previously worked at iRobot, and we left iRobot about 4 years ago. The first year and a half we spent developing our first prototype. And then when that was done, we thought we'd go off to look for venture capital financing. And we did that just as the economy was turning south. So we spent the next approximately year and a half looking for funding. We finally found that about a year ago in December, and we've spent the last year working on developing our new prototype, which should be able to do pretty much everything. And this prototype is sort of in the pre-alpha stage.
And what's your business model? What do you want to sell and to who?
Well, we're still exploring exactly what the business model will be. The sort of obvious one is that we build small robots and we sell them to growers, to people who own these this farms that grow the potted plants. But there's other options as well, and some that people have suggested to us are we could lease the robots, or you could rent the robots to growers, or you could even have a service company that that does the spacing. I'm not sure which way it's going to go.
You said that people, when you were developing the Roomba, were coming to ask you if you could develop window washing robots and such. Do you think with the robot you developed here, you can easily extend it to new applications?
Yes, absolutely. And that's really what we're counting on. It turns out that on these farms that grow container plants, there's lots of other applications that people would like to do. And I think that our robots will lend themselves to those applications as well. One of the things that has to be done is spraying chemicals or treatments on the plants. And it turns out that that's the least popular job on these farms, because you have to wear this hazmat suit to spray the stuff on the plants. That's one thing that the robots would be able to do. Another thing would be, you can, instead of just moving the plants around, you can imagine that each plant has certain nutrient and nutrient needs. If you had a sensor on the robot, and the time you moved the plant around, you stuck the sensor into the soil, you could tell exactly what the plant needed, and then that robot or another one could come along and supply whatever was necessary. That's just sort of the first step for on the container farms. If you want to then, as we probably will, want to move into more general agriculture, the next thing that you would look for would be some application which is a little bit more difficult than moving containers around. And the thing that has come to mind is, this is just an example, but a pumpkin, right? It could be in some ways similar to a container. The containers are really wonderful because they're all the same size and they're cone-shaped and they're on the ground, which all of those things make it easy for a robot to interact with them. But the next thing that you'd want to do would be to find something that's as similar to that. And the pumpkin, like I say, is somewhat similar in that it's on the ground. It comes in it's fairly easy to recognize. It's not as delicate as, say, a strawberry. So the robots would have a better chance of being able to manipulate the pumpkins. And then that's sort of the trajectory that we would see following through the space of products that we might like to build. Sort of each time we build a new application, it'll be a little bit more challenging, but still something within reach of the robot, and we think that that's important.
You just started testing your products in 16 places around the country. What is the reaction of these new customers?
Well, we're not quite to the stage of testing the products in the field yet. Like I say, we're still working on our pre-alpha prototype, but we did a lot of investigating the market before we went too far in this direction, and it turns out that the growers are really excited about it. In fact, the best example I can give is that there's three different growing companies that have invested in our company. They thought it was that this problem is so important to them that they were willing to invest in the company. So we were very pleased about that.
The last thing I wanted to ask is about your personal experience. You really worked in academia and in the industry, and I wanted to know what your secret is to bridge the gap.
Well, first off, it's tough. It's tough to bridge that gap. And I think one of the things that makes it tough is that basically academia and commercial interests they value different things. Academics always want to work on something that they can write a paper about, and business people want to work on something that will make the money. So when academics then turn to producing robots, what you often find is that they'll build a robot that's really, really cool, that's demonstrates something that they've been working on in a really cool way, but it may have no market at all. Business people, on the other hand, if they want to get into robots, they'll be attracted to big markets, and they will propose building some robot that may be completely out of reach technically. So to get those things together, and this is the same principles that we used on Roomba, is there's sort of three things. First off, you have to pick an application that people actually want done. You have to pick something which is technically within reach, and you have to pick an application that robots can do at a competitive price. And I think if you look in the history of robotics, you will see that there are abundant examples of companies that have failed on each or more of those things. So if you want to get academics and business interests together, my advice is to do those three principles. Do something that people want done, something that's within reach, and something that a robot can do at a competitive price.
Thanks, Joe, for being here with us on Robots.
Sure. My pleasure.
That's it for today's episode of Robots. For more information on our guests, have a look at our website at www.robotspodcast.com. Don't forget to have a look at our new news tab and comment on this episode.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks. Row Plants with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.